Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, episode 17, Paleolithic Solution. What's going on?
Dude, haven't been kicked off the airwaves yet, so we're barnstorming. I am not medicated this week, though, so it's guaranteed to be way less fun than previously.
And I only have a coffee, so there's not like a lot of excitement going on other than the fact that it's raining again in Chico, so once again, my mood is low, Rob.
Yeah, I definitely was considering a Kurt Cobain exit after this episode, so I'll wrap up the book and then, I regret nothing and launch myself off the cliff, so.
Well, you survived medication, you survived comments around women's hormones. I don't know there's much left for you to survive, Rob.
I don't know. And then why are you're going to Ohio? What do you have cooking in Ohio?
Oh, yeah, going to visit the folks this weekend. So we're recording this a couple days earlier. Recently put grandma in the nursing home, so going to check that all out and spend time with the family. And then my best friend just had the first baby. A couple of weeks ago, a baby boy. He was hoping that it was born on Super Bowl because he told me if your son is born on the day of the Super Bowl, he will play in the Super Bowl. And I told him I don't think that's how it works. And, I wanted to know what his 40 time was and et cetera. He said, well, his 40 time is kind of to be determined, but it's probably 7 or 8 hours at this point. and his squat form sucks right now, but he said they're going to work on it. He's only like 5 weeks old, so...
His spine is still more gelatinous than actually calcified. So
exactly. So in a year, he's expecting scholarship offers to come in, but he's got a little time of development to go before we actually test his 40. So
right on. Well, never too early to start planning, I guess. So
or dreaming, you know.
Yeah.
So that's it, man. That's the excitement. Hopefully, there won't be too much snow in Ohio. And, the farther I move west, the longer it takes to go back east or even the Midwest, as you well know. So I'm like, just longer trips than I prefer.
You need to start having kids so the parents come and see you.
We'll see what we can do on that, man. Patience, Rob. Patience.
Well, it's all in the trying anyway, so.
That's for sure. All right, so we're going to see how we do with the questions today, Rob. I think, as you said, there are some nice overlaps on a couple of them. I think we have some good questions, as always, so we're gonna roll. Cool. Actually, the first question is from one of my friends, and I'm not going to name her name, but she'll figure out who it is. So I got an email from her recently, and she said, I started my paleo diet cold turkey and tried to keep it minimal on fruit intake. So I'm just going to pause there and say, for this young lady, who probably weighs 115 pounds, her food intake is amazing. And you're talking about like a girl that could have like, she'd go to lunch, get like a foot-long sub and a 6-inch sub, and she could just eat a tremendous amount of food, although very carb-intensive, low on the protein side. And she's one of the lucky ones that would then still weigh 115 pounds.
Gotcha.
So even though her boyfriend is super strict, she's just starting. So... started paleo diet cold turkey, kept it minimal on the fruit intake. So by day three, she felt so sick that she couldn't do anything. She wants to know, is there a reason or did I do something wrong? Just wanted to see if you have run into this before or if you have any articles you could maybe send my way. Thanks.
Oh, man, do we have articles. I did a piece a while back. I think the title is The Zone in Athletic Performance. Mm-hmm. And that was actually a rebuttal piece to this guy, Mike Caviston, who's a kind of a SEAL trainer and coordinator. And I was just kind of making the point in there that a properly planned paleo zone kind of approach can not only be like, not injurious to performance, but should actually augment it and make it better. And there's a whole list of reasons for that. And one of the things that he had listed in this kind of slam piece on the zone was one or two clinical trials in which they looked at the zone, and it was very, very short duration, where they took a calorie restricted lower carbohydrate diet and put it into hard training athletes, and these athletes absolutely exploded. And so it's not really too surprising if you think about it. One, they use like the basic zone approach out of the recommended by like Enter the Zone. And then also when we look at some of the references that I had in there, there's a paper from the Journal of Nutrition and Metabolism on ketosis and athletic performance, we find that there's an adaptation period that takes about a month in which people shift over from a primarily carbohydrate-based metabolism to a fat and ketone-based metabolism. And during that transition, you can feel rough, like really, really bad, particularly like you seem to have laid a picture here in which this girl was eating really carbohydrate-dense foods, particularly some grain-based stuff. So her metabolism was just wickedly attuned to running on carbohydrate, you know, very, very dense, very refined carbohydrate. You pull that stuff out, and then it's funny, you mentioned day three, she felt so sick. Day three, 72 hours, is about the point at which you've completely depleted your liver glycogen and you start, your body starts looking around for some other nutrients to run off of, and it starts shifting into ketosis a little bit, but there's a rough transition point there because all of the metabolic machinery to use fat as a fuel source and ketones as a fuel source have not been ramped up. So she's in this kind of no man's land in which one fuel tank is empty, the carbohydrate fuel tank. The fat fuel tank is full, but the ability to access the body fat or even the dietary fat are very, very limited. And so this is a large part of why she's having such a problem with this. Now, one good question to ask or something to really point out with this, occasionally folks will get this notion that paleo means low carb, as in like only you know, non-starchy, non-dense carbohydrate sources, you know, no fruit, no yams, no sweet potatoes. But really, from my perspective, the whole paleo gig is mainly focusing on quality proteins, quality fat, and then quality carbohydrates that are not, you know, grain and legume-based for a whole variety of reasons, gut integrity and glycemic load and all that. But certainly having some fruit in the mix for this girl would make her transition much, much easier. In that article that I wrote, The Zone and Athletic Performance, there's a link to, I think, Chapter 9 of the Paleo Diet for Athletes, in which Joe Friel, who's the USA Olympic triathlon coach, he is made a bet by Lauren Cordain. Cordain bets him that if he starts eating a paleo diet, Friel will feel better and will perform better. And so Friel takes the bet. He has a three-week period where he feels like complete hell, and then he ends up ramping up and doing better, and he kind of lists all of his performance improvements and all that. But Joe was not limiting his carbohydrate intake. He was eating fruit, he was eating squash and all that sort of stuff. But even then, he still had a rough period of transition changing over to the kind of more paleo approach. So there's kind of graded steps here. She could jump in on this and keep fruit and yams and sweet potatoes in the mix, because it doesn't sound like she had, you know, she's maybe tackling this from like a performance perspective and a health perspective, so she doesn't necessarily have a lot of body composition issues. There's probably some metabolic derangement lurking in there, but she may be asymptomatic from the standpoint of like weight gain, but she would probably still benefit from a shift, because most people do. But you don't necessarily have to tackle this thing from a super low carb approach. You know, it's not entirely necessary. But I think so she could jump in, have some more carbohydrate, or she can recognize that there definitely is a transition period, even if she had more carbohydrate, in which she's probably not going to feel great for anywhere from a couple of weeks to close to a month. But then she should adapt, everything will ramp up, and she should be good to go from there.
Nice. And now that her boyfriend doesn't count almonds anymore, they'll be like one perfect happy family.
Awesome. And she will be even hotter than she is now.
So. Good. I thought that was a very good question, so I thought we'd throw that in there. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Next, we got a question from Jeremy. I don't think we have a perfect answer to this, but I think this is an interesting question to consider how we might work through a problem like this kind of in our gym, kind of how we see the world. So, hi, Rob. My name is Jeremy. I have a client who would like to start strength training in preparation for a fitness test conducted by her employer. She is a police officer who has been diagnosed with degenerative bone disorder. I'm waiting for a list of parameters from her doctor as far as exercise goes, but wanted to address her nutrition in the meantime. Any advice? Would this be considered an autoimmunity? Do you think it is possible to reverse this condition or just prevent further degeneration through proper coaching of strength training and nutrition?
Good, definitely a goodie. For me, I would need a little bit more information from this person. Like, what? Okay, so a degenerative bone disorder. Like, what exactly is that? Is it for sure like a degenerative bone deal? Sometimes people will mistake this stuff, and there's a very common situation of degenerative disc disease or degenerative joint disease. Degenerative disc disease can happen in the cervical spine of the neck or in like the lumbar spine, low back. You can get some degenerative joint disease, which Andy Deese can actually commentate upon with regards to like hips and stuff like that. So like you have to be really specific about what she has going on. Is this just kind of run-of-the-mill osteoporosis? Is this rheumatoid arthritis? Is this degenerative disc disease? Is this degenerative joint disease? So let's tackle each one of those, maybe from easiest to fix to a little more difficult to fix. If this is just run-of-the-mill, like osteoporosis, this is just kind of classic, probably not enough weight-bearing activity, probably not enough vitamin D, and then definitely, I would almost bet money that she has some sort of an acid-base imbalance in her diet, probably a lot of dairy, a lot of grains, possibly some soda because of the kind of phosphorus load from soda, and that in a net acid load format can end up leaching calcium out of the bones. And so our solution to that is lean protein, which causes an increased uptake in calcium, magnesium, zinc out of the intestines, contrary to the whole vegetarian kind of approach to meat. It actually ends up creating a net calcium retention environment, despite the fact that meat is definitely net acidifying at the kidneys. It ends up producing an acid load. So you can actually fix it with that, and then add in fruits and vegetables, and you get the calcium cofactor, which is magnesium, which ends up balancing so much of the metabolism that we would normally use calcium for when we're in a magnesium deficient state. It ends up relaxing smooth muscles and like a vascular bed, so it brings down blood pressure. There's a ton of things that we end up using calcium instead of magnesium for because we don't get enough magnesium in the diet. So there's an article from Lauren Cordain. It's in his Frequently Asked Questions section. If you just Google acid-base paleo, then you'll find that paper, and maybe we can drop this into the show notes. But that really explains the whole acid-base balance and how a paleo diet tackles the acid-base problem and how we end up with a net base or net alkalinizing diet, and it's very, very beneficial for bone health. So if her situation is osteoporosis, that would be the thing to do. Have her take in some vitamin D, maybe like 2,000 IUs of vitamin D3. Start strength-bearing exercise, load-bearing exercise, squat, deadlift, press, push press, body row, pull-up, all of that just standard strength training stuff. Work in a little bit of metabolic conditioning as you see fit, but really focus on the strength work. If she has an autoimmune condition like rheumatoid arthritis, then we need to immediately start looking at grains, legumes, and dairy, because if we're thinking autoimmune, then we're thinking leaky gut autoimmune response. I think we've talked about that quite a bit. I have a huge extensive chapter on all that stuff in my book. Basically, the deal with that, you remove all of these gut irritating foods, primary ones being grains, legumes, dairy. You might also look at nightshades like tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, red peppers, and all that sort of jive too, just as an initial intervention. You pull all that stuff out of the diet, make sure that she's getting plenty of fish oil, like about that half a gram per 10 pounds of body weight, and then see how she's doing a month later. Like these Pedro Bastos, our good friend who's at the University of Lisbon in Portugal, they are right now running another rheumatoid arthritis intervention in which they stick these people on a grain-free, dairy-free paleo diet, and they've had stunning, like 10 out of 10 people get resolution of their rheumatoid arthritis. Like it essentially goes into remission, and it's a very aggressive, gluten-free, dairy-free paleo diet, but with stunning results. So I can really, I feel like anything autoimmune related, we can really hang our hat on removing any of the gut irritating foods and seeing some remarkable benefit with that. And then from there, like if she does have an autoimmune disease, you want to be particularly careful of the ramp up on metabolic conditioning. Rhabdomyolysis is it greatly increased risk because her tissue was already inflamed, her immune system is already kind of hyperactive. So you want to really gingerly, carefully ramp this person up. You do not want to beat the dog piss out of them, you know, right from day one. You need to give some thought to scalability and all that sort of stuff. So that's osteoporosis, rheumatoid arthritis. If we're talking degenerative disc disease, I'll mainly look at the lumbar spine because that's the much more common one. Even the cervical spine. Most of I'll look at cervical spine first. I was going to just bypass that. Largely a postural issue, which can emanate from like cross syndrome, like tight chest, weak scapular retractors, tight hamstrings, weak belly, in which the person, it's kind of the belly sticks out, the chin sticks forward, the butt's kind of rammed back, and it's just this horrible postural position, which puts an anterior kind of slide, kind of anterior impingement on the cervical discs. And what will happen over time, these discs will get loaded because they're best designed. It's like a column. They're best designed to distribute load when they're in an even plane. But when we push them forward, then we start compressing the anterior aspect of that disc. And at some point, that compression will then start impinging on a nerve. And so I don't know if that's what this woman has, but if that is what it is, then you need to really, really address everything related to cross syndrome. So you need to do some Google searching. Coach Michael Rutherford is a guru on that stuff, both in addressing it and recognizing it and addressing it in a mixed modal strength coach format. Obviously, people like Dallas Hartwig and Kelly Starrett from a rehab perspective are going to be excellent on that. But you need to address just the basic postural setup. And then in the lumbar spine, if you hear about degenerative disc disease, L4, L5 kind of degenerative disc disease, in my opinion, it is like 99.9% hamstring tightness, hamstring piriformis, you know, hip mobility tightness. Normally, when we walk, the hips precess, they raise right to left, like it's almost like the Marilyn Monroe walks kind of thing, you know, where the right hip goes up, left hip goes up, but the spine essentially stays neutral in its orientation because the hips are precessing side to side. When we have super tight hamstrings, super tight hips, instead of the hips raising and falling side to side, it becomes like a mortar and pestle action on the L4, L5 discs, and you end up with a disc rupture at some point. Because it kind of wears them down. And then also you add to that any type of loading, sprinting, jumping, landing, lifting, when the lumbar spine is not in a solid position, is also going to expose the discs to a potential problem. So that's that whole gig. And then if you have something like a degenerative joint issue, like a hip or a shoulder, there can be various issues with that. Usually there's some sort of a movement or a recruitment issue, either tightness or impingement, that starts wearing out the joint prematurely. And then there again, you just need to be on top of that with proper mobility work and somebody like a Kelly Starrett or a Dallas or somebody like that who's well-versed in manual therapy to help open up the joint capsule, reestablish normal mobility so that you can cease damaging the joint. So that's hitting like every stinking thing under the sun. We still don't know for sure what this woman had going on, but that's like the... That's like everything it could be as far as I can understand. Maybe we'll get Dallas to chime in on that. I doubt if Kelly would be game for that because it'd probably get him fired. So there you have it.
Rob.
any thoughts on that, Andy? I mean, given
I'm on board with all that. I think the only other thing on the especially on that lower disc stuff, and you know, that's part of some of obviously I got some wacky hip stuff, is just also same thing, teaching folks how to use their stabilizers to properly stabilize their spine under load and not use some of the emergency stabilizers like the psoas and rectus to do some of those jobs and then, you know, kind of mess up the whole system. In other words, as Kelly says, Andy, get a freaking plan before you pick up that weight and shear your spine in half.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too far afield because this was already kind of a long answer, but this is... Again, some of my problems with the lack of a directed entry point for people doing various types of strength and conditioning, the simple statement of like, I'm going to scale something, when you start looking at it from like a perspective of dealing with a mixed population of people is nothing short of preposterous. Because we still have people, we were working with some folks last night who are overall pretty good movers, pretty good athletes, but they absolutely do not use their core stabilizers the way that they should. They're still using psoas as a anterior stabilizer of their midline, and they have low back issues as a consequence of that. And it just takes some time to teach people how to properly engage all the muscular, how to shut off the stuff they don't want to fire, how to turn on the stuff they do want to fire. And if all that they're being exposed to are deadlifts under like a 21-15-9 format for time, it's not a great, you're drilling in thousands of repetitions of shitty form instead of, you know, building a base that is built on a sound strength building movements, and then doing metabolic conditioning type stuff with movements that people have aptitude with that are more safe, and then layering in that complexity over time. And there's no 100% perfect answer to that, but I think just an orientation towards perfection in the compound movement, squat, deadlift press, push press, and really gingerly, hesitantly introducing that stuff in a metabolic conditioning format for sake of producing a better athlete in the long run. There's still plenty of things you can do with people to beat the dog piss out of them that are not reinforcing poor technique.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I do like, really like, about how we use, you know, very long, slow, linear progression, you know, at NorCal, just because then you can start folks at a reasonable amount of weight, make sure we groove all those patterns that we want, and they get better as the weight slowly but surely increases, and then by the time they've gotten to the point where they're lifting a substantial amount of weight, they are entirely comfortable with their setup, their stabilization strategy, and all they got to worry about is picking up the weight.
Right. Right, and you can do it in a way where people are still getting the shiny object, the Metcon, the kind of cardio dose that they're looking for, but just do it in a smart way so that you're not undermining that really important foundational strength work.
Yep. All right, good. Long answer. Cool. Good question.
Really long answer, yeah.
All right, next we got a question from Jay. He says, I don't want to be a nag. Jay, you're not a nag. Probably in the question queue somewhere, but anyway.
Now, Derek might be a nag.
Poor Derek.
We love you, Derek. We love you, dude.
Yeah, we're only down to 593 questions from Derek, but we'll get to him.
We as love
long
Derek.
As no one kicks us off the air.
Exactly.
Rob, I don't want to be a nag, but I asked earlier about training for health longevity versus sports performance and never got a reply, so I wanted to ask again in a way. Doesn't require a detailed answer unless you want to give one. My goal with fitness is very much about health and longevity and maintaining a high quality of life, i.e. no nursing homes. I have no desire to compete in the CrossFit Games or have a sub-3 Fran. Given this, I have an impression that training for my goals may be different than most in the CrossFit world. My inkling is that training for my goals might look more like 2 to 3 times week heavy lifting and 2 to 3 times doing short but intense Metcons or sprints. Is this a correct assumption? And if not, could you point me in the right direction?
I think the like short answer sort of gig is like, yeah, that looks good, like some sort of a lift some heavy stuff. Have a plan behind that so that you've got a ramp up and loading, some unloading weeks and all that, and then some smart time index Metcons. And then I forget, was it 2 shows ago, 3 shows ago, Andy and I talked a little bit about the need for some kind of long, slow distance, kind of volume type stuff. Like I just had surgery, so I've been limited in what I can do, but I've been setting up some things where I'll let a clock count down for like 45 minutes, and I'll just have a very long kind of circuit that I'm working on. I'll do some parallel bar passes on where I jump up on the gymnastics parallel bars, do some passes, do some sled drag, but it's all at a conversational kind of pace. You know, I could maintain a conversation with somebody, so it's at that like kind of 70% relative perceived effort. And I think a day or two of that in there, you know, I don't know if the perfect thing is, you know, 1 week you've got 3 days of strength work, 2 days of Metcon, 1 day of long, slow distance, and then you kind of rotate that template So like another week, 3 days of long, slow distance, you know, in long, slow distance being pretty relative, I think doing strongman type stuff, throwing a med ball, hiking with a vest, you know, there's just a bunch of different stuff. If you have some aptitude with boxing or kickboxing, just basically setting a timer and just kind of doing combinations on the bag. Like there's a lot of different stuff that you could do for that. And you could rotate that template very, very easily. I think that that's a really nice way to have kind of a health and longevity orientation within all the stuff, but keep some pretty damn good performance too. You're not going to win the CrossFit Games, probably not going to win a no lifting meet or a powerlifting meet, but I think you're it's kind of that classic some breadth and depth in like the 10 physical, you know, characteristics of Jim Cowley, and then the Glassman derived broad general inclusive fitness. I think you're pretty good. I think there's some good stuff with that. I think when you really early on, he asked the difference between like the sports performance and the health and longevity orientation. This is a point of departure that I have from like the current kind of CrossFit model, which is, you know, increase work capacity across broad time modal domains, and then the health and longevity orientation. I don't really see that, you know, when we present a model, the model should actually have some predictive value, and that model actually does not have any predictive value for either health, longevity, or optimum performance, because we know, like Barry Sears, even in his original book, he makes a strong argument for really limited exercise, because the studies of exercise are pretty clear that above a certain level, you start getting a decrease in longevity. We start getting enough oxidative damage and wear and tear on our body that it actually is driving us back the opposite direction. And this is something that I think it was July of 2004 that I wrote when I wrote the first intermittent fasting article for the performance menu. I touched on this, and since 2001, in talking with Dan John, I had had this idea in my head of performance, health, and longevity. Performance being basically whatever it is you want to do. It's more all-encompassing than just simply like work capacity. Work capacity may in fact be a performance parameter if you're a CrossFit athlete, but performance is way more specific of a deal if you are a shot putter or an 800 meter sprinter or a golfer or whatever. It's performance within your chosen field, and it's kind of interesting when you start digging around in some other definitions or looks at fitness, you get much more of an orientation on performance specificity. You know, you are fit for X, Y, or Z, you know, golfing, football, or the luge, or, you know, whatever it is that you're going for. And so I was looking at this performance kind of thing, and then health is just your moment-to-moment, you know, measure of health, like blood lipids, hormonal state, antioxidant status, all that sort of stuff. And then over time. And then there's certain trade-offs with all that. And then I cooked up a model that ended up looking very, very similar to a triple point of water, in which you have inflection points or deviation points, in which if you want better performance in a given activity, you are probably going to compromise both health on a short term and longevity on a long term. And then vice versa, if you really want to optimize health and longevity, health in the momentary format and then longevity in the long-term format, there is no doubt that your overall performance, most likely, whether your thing is CrossFit or jiu-jitsu or whatever, is going to be a compromise. And this is that kind of Art Devaney economics kind of based view of training and lifestyle, in which there are trade-offs, and the trade-offs are inherent, and we actually have some predictive value built around that. And I'm working on a paper with a little bit with Matt, a little bit with Professor Cordain, looking at integrating some of the like energy expenditure of hunter-gatherers, food intake, hepatic glycogen repletion, and all that, to try to model some legitimate inflection points, and then see if this stuff fits the data that we have out there. Can we support this with some data? So produce a model, see if there's some data that supports it, and that's way farther afield from where this thing started from. But I think the health and longevity piece can be complementary to performance, but the greater that performance orientation gets away from like our ancestral activity levels, like if you want to get really, really big and muscular, it's probably going to move you away from a health and longevity bias at some point. If you really, really want to orient on a health and longevity bias, then you would probably drop in some sort of pretty severe caloric restriction, maybe some intermittent fasting, but that's also probably going to limit your performance at any type of super high level in most things. There are some trade-offs with all that.
So what you're arguing, Rob, is that if I get 120 kipping pull-ups, I may have negatively impacted my long-term shoulder health?
Well, we may see some downside to that. We'll see. I think the kipping pull-up is therapeutic to the shoulder up until people cease to recruit properly on it, and then we start seeing some downside to it. So that'll be interesting to see how the greatest N of physical experimentation history has ever seen. See how that plays out.
Yeah. It's a super interesting question, Rob. That is my favorite Rob Wolf piece ever, by the way.
Which one is that?
The triple point, health, longevity, and performance.
Mm.
It's genius.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
I like
you.
It.
Thank
I like
you.
It, Rob.
We'll see if it's genius, if it actually offers some predictive value and is not just some hyperbolic flapping of my gums, and it might actually be valuable. So we'll see. Otherwise, it's just crap. So.
Well. No comment. All right, cool. Good question. Next, we got a question from Ed. I like this one. Rob, in reading some of Cordain's papers, and the one on hyperinsulinemia, more than syndrome X, he did with EADS, they say hyperinsulinemia causes increased growth. Yet, in the paleo diet, he states at the advent of agriculture, people got shorter. What's going on here?
Great question. Really, really good question. Also, just to toot my own horn, I'm going to mention that in that paper, one of the key points that are mentioned is this in the hyperinsulinemia, just the tip of the syndrome X, just the tip of the hyperinsulinemic iceberg, there's a section in there on epithelial growth factor being related to hyperinsulinism. And I actually contributed all of the research work based around that. So there's been some statements from certain health and fitness gurus that I've not contributed anything to any papers, and in fact that's inaccurate, and there's a few others floating around out there if they had taken the time to really research it. So that's one of them, and it's going to be important later because there's a subsequent question that talks about a skin condition that we will link back to hyperinsulinism and epithelial growth factor. So just keep that stuff in mind. So the question here is about, the paleo diet. When we're recommending a paleolithic diet, usually we're seeing ancestral growth patterns in which people were much taller than agriculturalists. And so that's one piece that we're seeing. But then also we're saying that with our now highly refined diet, we're seeing people with hyperinsulinism. And so what the heck is going on with all that stuff? And so if you look at the difference between the Okinawans and Japanese, the Okinawans get a pretty high protein diet. They get a low amount of rice, but the main carbohydrate source was kind of a dense, starchy tuber like a yam or a sweet potato, a very high carotenoid intake, but it basically was very, very low anti-nutrient content. And that's one of the main differences between the Okinawans and the Japanese, is that the Okinawans end up with a low anti-nutrient intake and therefore tend to be relatively tall. When you see first generation, second generation Japanese Americans, they tend to get much to, normal being, kind of relative, but normal within the westernized populations, the height distribution. So they end up taller because they end up with less rice in the diet, typically more dairy, which is also a growth promoter, but more protein overall. And so that's kind of the interesting thing that we're seeing here, that the paleo diet is growth promoting, in that it's adequate protein, good mineral balance, and no GI damage due to lectins and whatnot. But also it's very, very low in anti-nutrients, so you're not binding up like the calcium, magnesium, zinc, and all that sort of jive.
Good.
Anything yeah, great, one? Great Anything? Question, though.
Yeah. I like that one. And you actually contributed a scientific paper, Rob. Well done.
Hey, you know, pseudoscience reigns supreme, so there you go.
Your entire life is based on pseudoscience. So sad.
You know what, to tie back in, when they mentioned the hyperinsulinemia, a good example of this is the early dairy introduction and even greater than normal height distributions. And so we see that pretty consistently with early introduction of cow's milk, goat's milk, whatever. You tend to see kids being taller, which has some goods, but then also we see some interesting long-term epidemiology related to cancer rates. So there's some ancestral norms that we either approach and then surpass, and then some potential collateral damage with that.
Trying to say something about my height, dude.
Stress. Dude, you've taken care of everything. You will live to be 200.
No yeah, minus my hip.
Minus your hip. Your hip will maybe make it to 40.
All right. Enough tomfoolery, Rob. We're focused.
Indeed.
Question from David. Recently been doing a mass gain and have essentially been running on paleo plus milk. I've noticed a slew of sinus issues and congestion taking in so much milk, so I'm wondering if switching to paleo plus a whey shake may be of benefit. I read that you get less issues with just whey. Can you comment on that?
I this was from David. I actually did a brief little answer to David, and I said, you know, certainly give it a shot and then let us know how it goes. Makes sense that a whey only, you know, post-workout shake would be a good option. You're still getting some really potent growth promotion out of the whey, but yeah, it's the casein that seems to be a little bit more inflammatory. The casein seems to be a little bit more, or for me, quite a bit worse with regards to things like acne and some of the other collateral damage associated with inflammation. Definitely kind of sinus reactivity and all that too. Couple of thoughts on this though. Can you track down a grass-fed milk source, raw, unpasteurized? I personally have not really played around with it a lot, but there are a lot of people who claim that the raw, unpasteurized, you know, grass-fed milk is orders of magnitude less problematic with regards to the whole like inflammation, sinus problems, and all that sort of jive. And then the other thing is tracking down some goat's milk, which is usually grass-fed anyway. They may throw a little bit of grains in it, but it's usually grass-fed anyway. And I've noticed for myself, I can tolerate goat's milk much, much better than I can any type of cow's milk, even, you know, like goat yogurt versus cow yogurt, which I love yogurt, but I occasionally will treat myself to a big jug of plain goat yogurt, and I dig it. The goaty goodness is awesome. But that would be my thought. Definitely give the whey a shot if you want to. Other potentials are tracking down either goat's milk or grass-fed, ideally unpasteurized, unhomogenized milk. And in each one of those, maybe give each one a month and see how you run with it, a week, a month, you know, something like that, and see how you run with it.
So here's a question for you, Rob. So yeah. Obviously, generally, this paleo plus milk is sort of a short-term solution, trying to reach some type of goal, generally, for most folks.
Right.
What are your thoughts on the whey or the casein as far as the effectiveness, as far as, you know, related to bulking, adding strength, mass, etc.? Any perspective on that?
Like one versus the other?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, somebody like Berardi could probably answer a question like that more. I have not really looked at the anabolic potentials of all those things. Actually, Pedro Bastos might be able to hit him and see if he knows. All of these things increase a variety of growth factors. Insulin-like growth factor, epithelial growth factor, like I mentioned earlier. There's a ton of different things that they stimulate. I don't know what whey hits, what casein hits, a lot of the growth potential of dairy is a direct, trying to remember all this stuff, it's a direct activity of like insulin-like growth factor in the gut lining. So the there's intact insulin-like growth factor proteins in the dairy, which interacts with IGF receptors in the gut, which then stimulates IGF activity throughout the body. And IGF, insulin-like growth factor, is pretty damn anabolic. Like it has a really potent potential. Dairy also can potentiate the action of growth hormone. Insulin-like growth factor and growth hormone and testosterone all work in a really beautiful synergy, and promoting all of them is of huge benefit. When you stimulate the release of insulin, you decrease a hormone called sex hormone binding protein, which effectively increases free testosterone. So there's a bunch of different angles in which dairy is growth promoting, and it is just growth promoting above and beyond the caloric content. Not only does it have big caloric content, not only can you slug down a quart or a half gallon or a gallon comparatively easy, as compared to, like, you know, a gallon is 3,800 calories. Like, it's comparatively easy to drink 3,800 calories versus like eat 3,800 calories. So it's very, very calorically dense in that regard. But there's growth promotion above and beyond that, and the synergy does seem to work better. But to what degree they separate out, I don't know.
All right. Well, it was worth a shot, Rob.
Yeah, we can try to do that. That's just outside my wheelhouse. We could try to do a little research on that, maybe see if Pedro Bastos can comment on that, because he put together a hugely well-researched paper on the kind of the totality of the known endocrine response to ingesting dairy.
All right. So, cool. That might be worth a look.
Yeah, totally.
Good. Here we go. Next, got a question from Kim. Just started listening, but already a huge fan. So this is like fan 9, Rob, whatever number you're making
sweet
up.
Sweet. Right. I think people are dropping off the front end, though. We're still around 6. I know it. So.
This podcast, you've mentioned sleep quite a bit. I've just started to really dial in my food and have progressively been getting better at going totally strict. This last week, I have done strict paleo and cut out fruits and nuts, getting my carbs to about 30 grams from veggies. But now I've been sleeping quite a bit more, going on about 10 hours a night. Well done. Mm-hmm. And still feeling pretty exhausted at different points throughout the day. Is this typical? When you talk about sleeping enough, what is the range you're thinking of? Because 10 hours is kind of cutting into my schedule.
Seriously. Two thoughts here. Just bouncing right back to that original blog post or a question here, might be going too low carb. Like this is all in the context of like what Kim is wanting to accomplish, and maybe this is too low carb. Some of the lethargy may just be adaptation to a more fat-based metabolism. So I mean, maybe she needs a little more fruit, and she would feel better if she's not trying to lean out. That seems like a totally appropriate way to go. If she is trying to lean out, this may just be kind of the way it's going to be until she adapts to the higher fat, lower carbohydrate intake. So just need to think about what Kim's goals are overall. And then something to keep in mind too, if you're in the northern hemisphere, we're kind of, you know, midwinter, you know, there's a niggling hint of spring looming out there, but we're still more winter than not. And people tend to sleep a little bit longer in the winter, anywhere from like a half hour to an hour. And I think it's normal to be a little bit slower to wake, a little bit lower energy. I know, like Andy and I already commented, you know, it's rainy and cold again in Chico, and you're just less energetic. So I don't know if she has some environmental factors going on there. But I would just think about, you know, does she need to lean out? If not, maybe she can reintroduce a little bit more fruit, because otherwise, I mean, not super compelling that she be super duper low carb on this thing. If she is trying to lean out, then maybe just keep goose stepping along with this, and just know that 3 to 4 weeks in, she's going to feel better. And then also keep in mind that her sleep, if she's in northern hemisphere, that pretty high likelihood that her sleep requirements may be a little bit higher right now. And then when the summer rolls around, it'll probably drop almost 2 hours.
Rob, if you slept that much every night, you could not goof off on the internet and start arguments.
I haven't really argued that much.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I could. I just wouldn't get any of my book done, and then my wife would kill me.
There'd be a long line behind your wife, I suspect, Rob.
That's good to know.
Be chased through the streets.
Perfect, perfect.
You've only been plugging for like a year, I feel like. So
actually, it's about 5 years.
That's right, okay. But hard selling it for a year. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, next we got a question from Vinny. When we get to the hard part, Rob, I'm going to let you pronounce this.
Oh, man, okay.
Rob, I have an issue that I think would be good discussion for the podcast. I've been on and off Primal Eater for about 8 months now. My original motivations were to achieve the all-encompassing look-good naked status. But as I read more and find more research, my motives are also pointing me towards some serious health benefits I may receive as a result of eating Primal. So here's my question. I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis when I was 17. The disease has been a constant struggle for me, and up until that point, I had always been overweight, and my diet was ridiculously poor. Even now, fat loss is a struggle, constantly yo-yoing and getting derailed for weeks after even the slightest deterrence from a strict paleo routine. As far as my colitis goes, my symptoms practically disappear when eating a gluten-free paleo diet, while extra fat also seems to melt away within a month or so of good eating habits and CrossFit WODs 5 times a week. Recently, I've also been displaying symptoms of
hidradenitis suppurativa.
Nice. Yeah. A skin disorder resulting in big pistules? What?
Pustules.
Pustules, thank you. You can tell you're the scientist. I'm just a hack. Around my inner thigh and pubic area. After much reading on the subject, I found that this skin disease can also be traced back to a gluten-laden diet. In my constant reading, I've also found that celiac disease can closely mimic the symptoms of ulcerative colitis and is often misdiagnosed as such. I was hoping that your science background could help shed some light on this. It all adds up too easily. It's hard for me to lose weight unless I cut out the gluten. My ulcerative colitis symptoms disappear when I do, and I now show signs of a skin disorder when I eat gluten-rich foods. I'd like to hear some of the physiology behind these occurrences and hear whether you think that I may have been misdiagnosed and why or why not this would be possible. Also, you get this a lot, but I'd like to also thank you for all the work that you do. Keep it up, and thanks again.
Big question. On the whole deal of the, you know, diagnosis, misdiagnosis, something to keep in mind with all this stuff when we're talking about any type of like GI problem, you know, leaky gut and the autoimmune response, what we're finding is that a significant vector of the autoimmune response, and we've said this thing a bunch of times, is the transglutaminase enzyme. Transglutaminase modifies proteins. It modifies damn near every protein that comes out of our body. And so we can see effects of gluten on literally every tissue and organ system in the body. And so whether or not this thing is diagnosed correctly or incorrectly, you know, like ulcerative colitis, or is it gluten intolerance, or is it actually irritable bowel syndrome, it all kind of boils down to the same stuff. And what we find is that you remove the gluten out of the diet and you see an alleviation, essentially a restitution of these symptoms. They go away. You introduce it, and then you have problems. And this hidradenitis suppurativa,
Suppurativa.
I have not seen this one before. When I started researching for this thing, it was kind of the first go around at it. You see some linkage not only with autoimmunity and this condition, but you see a really, really high linkage with insulin sensitivity. It actually is wickedly high in type 2 diabetics, and then also particularly in women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, which also underlying linkage in that situation is hyperinsulinism. It's high insulin. So when we start trying to drag all this stuff together, when we consider some of the information from like the Katavans, we start seeing that this distinction between elevated insulin levels and autoimmunity, in my opinion, starts becoming very, very gray, because I think that there's the leptin resistance, body becomes non-responsive to leptin, which may be precipitating the lion's share of what we see as hyperinsulinism. The leptin sensitivity disappears. Leptin really strongly regulates our uptake of fats and carbohydrates and our sense of hunger. That cascades into insulin. Our insulin is our primary storage hormone. If we start becoming resistant to the actions of insulin, then we start getting some of these hyperproliferative growth situations like acne and like this condition. This condition is like a really, really wickedly bad case of acne. And so we see some very common linkage here, and it's really not surprising. And the solution still boils down essentially to that same thing, this gluten-free, dairy-free kind of paleo diet. It's funny, James Krieger, was that the guy's name?
Uh-huh.
That was posting some stuff. Like he really took Gary Taubes to task and was, you know, I think he's probably a pretty good dude. He's definitely in the camp with Alan Aragon and Lyle McDonald and all those guys who are very much not like paleo fans, and that's fine, whatever, you know, state your case, run with it, that's fine. I respect those guys for where they're at. But James was trying to make this point that, like, you know, fat obesity was a problem with NEAT, like basically fidgeting. It's like, I forget what the acronym for NEAT was. It's let me pull it up here really quick. It's non-exercise activity. Non-exercise activity, something another. But it's basically, one second. NEAT, insulin, no, not that. But he's making this argument.
Thermogenesis, non-exercise,
something another, thermogenesis.
Activity, thermogenesis, NEAT.
Okay, that's it. That's the stuff. So James is making this point that it's not insulin, it's NEAT. It's how much you fidget. And I was kind of like, well, you start doing a little bit of digging around on NEAT, and there's massive disparity from one person to another. And like if you overfeed them 1,000 calories, one person will fritter away all 1,000 extra calories by being fidgety, and their body temperature will go up. And then somebody else, they won't, they'll only fritter away like 100 calories. And then so there's some obvious difference there. And then when you do a little bit of digging, it looks like there's an autoimmune component to the NEAT deal. And so it loops back again to like, okay, Neolithic foods are probably at cause here. You know, the thermodynamic deal, you know, it's calories in, it's calories out. It's like, yeah, kind of, sort of, but not really, because we still have these really complex nonlinear mechanisms going on. And it until we see one uniform response across pretty much everybody, then we're, you know, it's kind of hard to hang your hat on it. And the thing that I'm finding nearly across the board is that if you remove these gut-irritating foods, then we see seemingly complete alleviation of these autoimmune conditions, you know, like just across the board. So that's where I'm really, really hanging my hat more than anything, is just on that gut irritation and everything that comes out of that. So this is for sure an example of this, in which he's got some obvious ulcerative colitis type stuff, some obvious gluten intolerance, and then some collateral things that look like insulin resistance. And it may be overt insulin resistance from grains, legumes, dairy. It could be insulin resistance plus autoimmunity out of those things. And we really don't know for sure what the total story is on that. But the fundamental thing is he knows if he pulls this stuff out, he ends up going symptom free. You know, he doesn't have a problem then.
Yeah. So this is one, I think, for us where it's like, I don't know that it matters long term. It may matter to him, but I think the solution is still the same either way.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to be asymptomatic, you got to pull the grains, legumes, dairy out of the mix, and then experiment and see to what degree you can or can't reintroduce that stuff. And I think, again, you know, stuff like corn and rice, you can usually get away with on a infrequent exposure. Gluten seems to be kind of a nasty one under any circumstance.
For sure. All right. Good. Good question.
Cool.
Question from Kevin. Hey, Rob, a bit off topic, but would you happen to know of any sites which have references to studies done on dogs and gluten, wheat, corn issues, possibly some of the side-by-side studies of dogs fed an ancestral diet versus a conventional PetSmart garbage? So far, I found that our vet is pretty clueless about the dangers of corn, gluten, wheats, etc. for dogs. This The dog has already gone through a several-day bout with allergies because of the Purina crap food she recommended with corn gluten meal. The results of feeding Evo seem to be speaking for themselves, but I would love to find some more solid studies on this.
Yeah, I did a quick little look, and there's a little bit out there, but it's not that well developed. I mean, it's kind of similar to where human nutrition is, in which the you get a few practitioners, few doctors, few vets who really get what's up with this, and then you have the vast majority that just have no idea. And so we'll do, maybe if any listeners know about some specific sites or some specific veterinary practitioners who are savvy to the whole like kind of ancestral diet for cats, dogs, all that sort of stuff, then that'd be great. We could put some links up for some stuff like that, but offhand I don't know a whole lot of them, but the results are obvious in this situation. Like the same deal, you pull the grains out of the diet for cats and dogs, and I think it's even more stunning the resolution that they have with some of their problems. Arthritic conditions, a lot of dogs that are claim to have problems with like hip dysplasia and stuff like that. I think it's fully like a malnutrition scenario. They're fed crappy food. If you fed them more of a raw diet or even just like a cooked meat, veggies kind of diet, they load them up with fish oil. They do great. And these breeds that normally are associated with hip dysplasia and stuff, they have virtually no problem. Like it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, and you do have, I recall, the Pottinger cat studies, which is a little different, you know, but they did a lot of stuff on, I feel like it was like 900 generations or something, but a large number of skeletal deformities and all types of interesting stuff. So, and this is one where I would be curious just to see how old the vet is. Like, my parents' vet, whatever, we always have cats, so I'm a cat person, but our vet's like in his late 70s and still practicing. And, you know, over the 30-some years, my parents have had cats. Obviously not the same one for 30 years, but some lasted into their early 20s. They would develop these weird, you know, kidney situations or just a lot of weird gut irritation and stuff. And, you know, finally, in recent years, my mom asked the doctor, and he was just like, it's all the food. He's like, 30 years ago, you know, the cats I treated didn't get any of these things. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, his opinion over time, he's like, they just... complete, you know, change in the diet has totally caused all these downstream consequences that, you know, now his approach really isn't to worry about changing the food. He's kind of like, it is what it is. The cats are going to be sick. But
right.
I thought it was interesting, you know, kind of from someone from an outside perspective, not really from the paleo paradigm, kind of being, yep, we change what they're eating. Here's what happened to them.
Right, right. Yeah, just complete clinical observation on the whole thing. Like no real background theory at all. Yeah.
All right. Good. Number 9, question from Warren, I think. Just want to clarify, avoiding dairy would mean milk, cheese, yogurt, half and half butter, but half and half butter and cream would... Okay, let me start again, Rob. Clearly my coffee's wearing off. Avoiding dairy would mean milk, cheese, and yogurt, and half, but butter and cream would be okay. Is it because they are mostly pure fat, but others have casein and lactose? Going to do the whole pull dairy out for a month to see, but butter and raw cream have to go too. What are your thoughts on this, Rob? I'm totally like tongue tied. I have too much coffee right now.
Andy has gone beyond his therapeutic dose on coffee. He's starting to shut down. He's taken enough uppers for them to be downers now.
Well, you know what it is? Is I had my 3 tablespoons of heavy cream in there. So I feel like I'm spinning.
Yeah, the heavy whipping cream really, like we talked about, really enhances the caffeine uptake. What you need is a Valium now, and it'll perk you right back up.
It'll bring you back down to normal.
So, the people that I would pull dairy out of the lineup in totality would be folks who have autoimmune issues or who are really, really, really trying to lean out. I just like scorched earth, give it a month. And then we'll play around with it. And then, like Warren is saying, the things that I would try reintroducing would be like butter and heavy whipping cream, ideally pastured because of the fat content, and it would minimize the lectin issues in that situation. And that's kind of the main deal that I would look at for that. So leanness because of the insulin spiking, and then also the autoimmune potential there.
Yeah, sorry about that noise, Rob.
No problem. That was Andy popping a Valium so he can get back in the game here.
I misclicked. It was a poor click. All right, I'm sorry. I was trying to look something up. Anyway, go ahead.
No, that's it on that. And then get a booze question.
Yes, the ever important booze. Also, can you give small amounts of booze and dry red wine a pass, but no mention of beer? I know I asked about this before in terms of gluten, but no carb count, metabolic effect. Some light beers carry about 3.5 to 5 grams carbs.
Yeah, I mean, the beer deal is mainly the gluten issue. You can track down some Red Bridge or a gluten-free beer. You might tolerate that better. But like I mentioned before, there are some people like Dutch Lowy and a couple other people that are reactive to gluten in general, but react worse to sorghum beer than they do regular wheat-based beer. And so that's just kind of, they seem even more reactive to sorghum. And so there's that thing again where there's a big variety within all this. Apparently there are some people who react very, very unfavorably to corn too. Like I usually give corn and rice a pretty good pass, but I've been reading some stuff on some people who end up with serious GI problems looking like ulcerative colitis and some vectors for autoimmunity from corn intake. And so I think that there's a big genetic variation on here. You legitimately, like Steve Rast, who's a dude who helps set up CrossFit Fenway, and then he's moving out to Oregon. Really good dude. He's kind of reminds me of like one of our guys, John Fragoso. He's kind of like Wolverine. Like he's just jacked, built, strong, and can eat like 10 cans and doesn't affect him. And he legitimately is a guy that he's like, you know, I've really tried gluten-free, dairy-free, paleo, and then I've done like beer and pizza, and I just don't notice the difference. And when you look at him, you're like, so how much do you lift weights? And he's like, once or twice a week. And the dude's just like huge and jacked. I'm like, okay, I hate you. So there are a few people out there that like really they just don't, man, their reactivity to this stuff is minimal. But the big reactivity issue for me with this is just the gluten content of the beer, the carbs. I'm not really all that concerned about.
Yeah, I think this goes back to kind of that whole wheat bread versus a banana thing. We're on the basically, you know, the quality side of the equation versus the carb or the macronutrient breakdown the side of the equation.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, two more questions from Warren, the last one being the most important. But question, pure stevia okay in small amounts?
If you want to sweeten something, just use some sugar, I guess. I don't know. I mean, if you
Rob,
like
it's natural. I'm waiting for your analogy here.
I've killed this analogy yet. Plutonium is natural too. So, you know, stevia causes an insulin response in a lot of people. It makes people hungry after using it. If you want to use it, go for it. You know, but like if you're making like a mixed drink or something, like I would just be horrified making a mojito or something. You've got top shelf like Nicaraguan rum. You throw a bunch of mint in there. You mix it all up. You put some lime juice and some soda water. And then you're like, some pure cane sugar or stevia. And I would just want to kill the person who would put stevia in there. It's like, you know, either make it like a skinny margarita or skinny mojito. Or if you want to sweeten it up and use the real thing. You know, just use some moderation on it. And here again is the deal that if you're trying to lean out or you have some other issues, then don't use any sweeteners until you get your shit squared away. And then if it is squared away, then it shouldn't matter. You should be able to kick your heels up a little bit and have some fun and not, you know, not worry about little details like this. So,
all right.
Really, again, it really depends on where you're at in the whole spectrum.
And then last question, he says, most importantly, why no mention of thrashing? Well, because I think it's Thrash In, if I recall, which is a phenomenal Josh Brolin skateboarding movie. It's amazing that Josh Brolin ever skateboarded, but I guess that shows how old this movie is. It came out in the early 80s. So, you know, I told Rob I'm going to try to tone down my movie references, but I appreciate the the reminder of another fine movie from my childhood.
We just need to get some more Gross Point Blank references.
Oh, man, you can never have enough of those, for sure.
Yeah. Just want to put it out there. I wouldn't want to make you uncomfortable.
Have you seen Thrashin', Rob?
I have. You know, I did ages ago. So okay. Yeah, it's been ages. It not was like, definitely beta or VHS when I saw it. So
for sure. Unlike Prayer of the Roller Boys, you have seen this, you know, bit of pop culture history. That's good. I feel better right now.
Yes.
All right. Next, got a question from Mike. Hey, Rob, thought you might have discussed this at some point, but couldn't find it in the archives. Is constipation common on a paleo diet? I've been eating strict paleo, supplementing with vitamin D, magnesium, and fish oil, and recently started taking the Now Food Super Enzymes. However, I only go 1 to 2 times a week. Not sure if this is unhealthy or if there is a way to remedy it.
It's really common for people in the beginning when they switch around to a paleo diet to have some kind of slow bowel movements, to be a little bit constipated because their system is kind of primed or used to using the gut irritating effects of grains to basically, you know, stimulate peristalsis, stimulate the movement of food through the intestinal lining, and you know, make you go poop more often. The analogy that I use is, you know, if you eat some hot food, eat like some hot peppers or some really hot Mexican or Thai food, what happens to like your nose or mouth? And people say, well, it runs. And it's like, yeah, so you get a bunch of mucus discharge. This gets really yummy. Hopefully people are like eating some dinner while they're listening to this. But you get some mucus discharge, and this is identical to the scenario in which your guts get exposed to some sort of a irritant, grains, legumes, kind of, you know, hot food sort of gig. And you get increased peristalsis, increased mucus production, because it's an irritant and your guts are trying to move it out. It's trying to dilute it, and it's trying to move it out. So the things to do when you transition into a paleo diet, make sure you're getting plenty of fish oil, plenty of fat in general, lots of water, you know, the magnesium and all that stuff is good to go. And then it's probably just going to take a little while to fully adapt to that scene. But it's normal, and you should get some sort of adaptation within, about a month, 3 weeks to a month, something like that.
All right. Yeah, we see this pretty commonly at the gym, and then eventually it does sort of resolve over time, but there seems to be a fairly wide window for folks. Some folks adapt pretty quickly, and some folks takes a few weeks easily.
Right, totally.
All right, and finally, a question from Sue Rob. I don't know why. I think we've visited this before, but I was in the mood to put this in here for you. I think it was the rain. The rain. Rob, what do you think of vegan athletes? Do you think it's possible for someone to be at their best athletically while a vegan?
I answered this one in a brief written response to Sue, and it went pretty much like this, which is that if we look to the absolute, and somebody, I don't know if it was last time, maybe it was last podcast, where somebody said, was it the question where it's like, I haven't seen any elite athletes doing paleo other than like Mark Twight or something like that. So it's in this kind of genre, which is you could find somebody who's ultra elite, like Carl Lewis is one of the only, like gold medaling vegan athletes that I can think about. But there are people out there who, God, who's the football player? There's a football player that just turned 50, and he ran a legit laser timed combine style timed 4.4140, and he just turned 50 years old, you know, and he used to have like a 4.1 or something, or 4.17, some ridiculous thing. I forget who it is, but it's like I couldn't run a 4.47 unless I was shot out of a cannon, right? You know, my fastest day, and I'm a reasonably fast guy, had a good vertical leap and all that. And so there's just so much individuality out there. You could have somebody who is still a gold medalist, but eating suboptimally. And we see stuff, examples like that all the time. Wellborn mentioned guys who would do absolutely no training in the off season, sit and watch like Scooby-Doo all off season, and come in the gym and beat him on all the lifts and on all the combine stuff. And they would just kind of like laugh at him, where Wellborn would hire a strength coach and work his ass off during that time. But he found pretty quickly that there was kind of this optimized nutrition that gave him better performance, which was essentially a paleo diet on kind of a cyclic low-carb regimen, and then smart training, talking to Eva Tuardokens, kind of the same deal. Like, she had to train smart and eat smart to be at the highest level that she could be, but yet there were still people who out of the box could beat her, you know, at a giant slalom skiing. So in my general heart of hearts, I have to say that I don't think veganism is going to produce optimum performance for people. Now, you can have some funny what I think is funny interpretations of this, like the Mike Mahler vegan, in which he eats six meals a day, and he has a bunch of whey protein shakes or like brown rice protein and all this sort of stuff. And what you're doing is you're taking vegan food sources, or I don't know if he's vegan, so he's not doing whey protein, so it must be like brown rice protein or something like that, like tofu or something. But you're essentially emulating a paleo diet, or at least a meat-based diet, with vegan concentrates, which really, when you get right down to it, that's all a cow is. It's concentrated grass. So I'm just kind of like, I'm completely unimpressed and nonplussed by that stuff. It's like, dude, I get my concentrated grass from a cow. You get it from soybeans. You know, I'm just not seeing the relationship there. Eat some raw, unchanged food. Like, eat beans, rice, nuts, seeds, fruit, vegetables, and show me the same results. And then you've got something that would kind of impress me a little bit. And so Andy's like, dude, wrap this thing up. So my thought here is that, you know, you've got huge genetic variation. So you can have elite level people who potentially are vegan, but I think they would potentially train even better if were they not. The ways that people tweak the whole vegan thing to make it work is almost silly to me, because if you want to do it. I don't care. I really have no dog in the fight at all. Do whatever you want to do. But if you need to eat a bunch of like protein concentrates and stuff, and you're doing it for moral reasons, fine. If you're doing it for some perceived health reason, then I think you're completely missing the mark. And then a lot of what I base this off of, we trained a family of vegan, kind of Seventh-day Adventist, really, really good people. Like, love all of them, really good folks. One or two of the family members ended up peeling out and getting into the chicken, egg, fish scene. They never really stepped up to the red meat, which is fine. That's not necessary to make this stuff work well. But those two people who stepped out, now these are all essentially people from the like same genetic lineage. You know, they're all one family, basically. The folks who ended up maintaining this almost vegan, like, they would occasionally do some dairy or some cheese or something like that, but they were basically kind of vegan sort of deal. They saw better performance when they started training with us. They saw some uptick in their lean body comp and all that, but it really plateaued rapidly. And then their siblings, who ended up eating essentially a paleo diet, like a mixed paleo diet, they absolutely destroyed them, like crushed them. Body composition was way better. Recovery, you know, was way better. Performance was just astronomically better. And then when we look at some examples that we have, like Laura DeMarco, and again, these are like kind of N equal one, but Laura was a very good athlete, unweighed, unmeasured, you know, a high-carb, low-fat vegan athlete, then became a vegan zoner and saw better performance, then became unweighed, unmeasured paleo athlete, and she has destroyed every other benchmark that she's ever had. And like, I just see this again and again and again. And so for the, you know, I obviously have beat this thing to death. If people are really adamant one way or the other about this, I would say eat vegan for a month and then eat straight up paleo for a month. And how do you look? How do you feel? How do you perform? And then you can completely, you know, answer that question. From my experience, I don't see veganism transfer the way that a mixed diet paleo works. And that's even with using stuff like brown rice protein powder and stuff like that. So there you have it, Gatto.
The Gatto is interrupted. Well, we're at an hour 15, Rob. We're back up the hour mark.
Holy
Or we're close to an hour 15. So with that, man, I think we're going to call it the end of episode
17.
Yeah, we survived. We're almost to 20. Whoever thought we'd see that day?
I didn't figure I'd see episode 2. I figured I'd be shot at that point. So.
Or the cat would get tired of listening to you. Seriously. All right. I'm going to let you go, Rob. We're 20 seconds to an hour and 15, so I'm going to stop it right now, and then I'll talk to you next week, assuming
Have fun in Ohio.
Thanks, dude. See
ya. Thanks, Andy. Bye.